Welcome to Last to Leave, a podcast all about giving a voice to a wide variety of collaborators in film and television. People who are the last to leave set typically aren't the first to be interviewed about their work, and we're here to share their stories. I'm Zoe Danielson.
And I'm Heather-Lane Abbott. And welcome back, Zoe.
Hi.
We've got truly a one-of-a-kind interview coming up. But first, we want to chat a little bit about the movie. Molly and Max in the Future is a sci-fi rom-com independent film written, produced, and directed by Michael Luke Litwack and edited by Last to Leave fave Joanna Nagle, who you'll know from our episode on The Bear. And literally, it's crazy that we did this interview.
it's bananas for sure.
I remember when we interviewed Joanna, she mentioned this movie and we were just kind of like, I wonder if maybe we could talk to her and her husband about it. That would be pretty cool. And then they were down, which was pretty sweet.
Yeah, we were like, I feel like so sheepish about it. Like, Joanna, like, would you both maybe be interested? And yeah, just like so incredibly pumped when they said yes and they wanted to chat with us.
Yeah. And this was also a Last to Leave first because it was our first screener.
Yeah, we felt pretty official getting a screener.
Yeah. Zoe, will you paint me the scene of our first watch? Because we did make a night of it. It was pretty special.
Yes. Okay. So picture this. Fun lights, purples, pinks. Heather walks in. Wow, we have two couches and we face them forward to face a projector that we had set up. And I can't remember what the snacks were, but I think it was a cheese board. We had a bit of a cheese board moment.
Yeah, it was a really good cheese board. There were multiple cheeses, crackers, apples. It was delicious.
Yeah, so we had some good snacks and we watched it and we just loved it so much.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had like a sense of what it might be just with the log line that they gave us of it being like When Harry Met Sally in space. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, like I probably have a sense of it. But I mean, also knowing that it was like a independently financed, independent film, you know, you assume it's going to be pretty small scale. And this movie's anything but small scale. Like the visuals that they accomplished are so beautiful. And I mean, yeah, I can't speak highly enough about the work. And you'll get to hear, you know, in the interview, Michael talk about how they achieve these things because it was like just such a testament to like the creativity of humans and like what you can pull off when you have to. Had so much love and care put into it. And I feel like that like comes off the screen and it makes it so much fun to watch.
Yeah, so much fun and care, so many fun little Easter eggs, but like on top of it all, just like it really felt like I was watching something made by people who were having a lot of fun. And I think that that just like injects so much into it, watching those behind the scene clips and seeing them literally building the backgrounds and all the lighting techniques that they use.
And all the miniatures.
Oh, God, the miniatures built. We don't want to spoil anything, but yeah, there are just so many. It's one of those films where it's like, it feels like a scrapbook. Like every time I watch it, I feel like I uncover new things, and I have watched it multiple times, like since the first time we saw it. And it's like every time, you know, every frame you see something new, it's really fun to watch. It's a delight.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Hell yeah. And the timing for this interview coming out is pretty iconic because the movie does premiere in theaters literally today for our Chicago listeners. I'm so excited to share this interview, but before we can do that, we have to rate the movie. Mm-hmm. And I think you have a very special rating system for us. Will you introduce it?
Our rating system is how many Diet Glorps out of 5. I love a good like fountain soda. I love a soda period. So when I, you know, learned about Diet Glore, instant stan. That's all.
Hell yeah. So on a scale of 1 to 5 Diet Glorps, how glorp was this movie?
Thank you for asking. This movie was just like a million liters of Diet Glorp out of 5. And not only are they like just liters by themselves, like I've thrown in Mentos and they're, you know, popping off and we're having a party.
I think I'm going to give it a 1,600,000,000,000. That's a confusing way to say it, but I'm sticking to it. 1,600,000,000,000 fountain Diet Glorps in a tank that was like they just restocked the CO2. So it is bubbling.
Yes.
It is getting you giddy. It is making you feel excited. It's reminding you that love is real and exists, which is a big feat for some of us right now. Yeah. I love this movie so much. And I cannot wait to see it again, but this time on the big, big screen.
The score is jazzy, people. What more do you want? It's jazzy. <We're> saxes.
Oh, and we are sax stands on Last Leave.
We are. That's Last Leave, proven fact. But without further ado,
I have to say that every episode is special, but this one is definitely a first for us. We have two incredible guests who just so happen to have been instrumental to a new independent film, Molly and Max, in the future. We may be slightly breaking our own rule by chatting with a true triple threat, who is the writer, director, and producer on the film, along with a returning guest who edited it. So without further ado, I'd love to welcome Michael Luke Litwack and Joanna Noggle to the pod. Hi, guys.
Hello. Hi, thanks for having us.
Hello, thanks for having us.
Joanna. Something exciting just happened.
Yes, definitely.
Uh-oh. Congratulations on your Emmy win.
Thank you. Yes, we were just in LA about 2 weeks ago for the Creative Arts Emmys, and I won the award for picture editing for a comedy series for The Pilot of the Bear, which is so cool because I cut it back in September of 2021. So it's kind of wild that it's taken this long to kind of do the awards cycle, but just so grateful to be part of the team. So grateful to the rest of the assistant editors, everyone who helped on season 1 and 2, and we're getting ready to jump into season 3. So I can't wait.
Oh, that's amazing. And very well deserved because the editing on The Bear is incredible. And if you haven't gotten a chance to listen to Joanna's episode about her work as the editor, one of the editors on The Bear, you absolutely have to check it out. We dive deep into her background and gush about how much we all love the show. But since this is Michael's first time on the show, we'd love to do a deep dive into his background. So Michael, could you talk to us about how you found yourself pursuing a creative career?
Yeah, you know, I grew up in Los Angeles and I kind of grew up watching big budget action adventure spectacle films, which is, I think, the way that a lot of people kind of get into movies when they're kids. So, you know, movies like Star Wars and Jurassic Park and Indiana Jones, movies that are kind of plot driven about kind of escapism. And, you know, they still have great characters, but it's maybe not the first thing people mention when they talk about those films. But as I kind of got older, I found myself kind of gravitating towards a different type of movie, which is something that is maybe a little bit more character first, you know, movies like Annie Hall and Itu Mama Tambien and the Before trilogy and movies about people like living in major metropolitan cities and complaining about their therapists and dealing with like very kind of normal, real, relatable problems. And you know, they still have style and have a point of view. So it's not necessarily just about like realism, but stuff that is a little bit more like reality based. And I moved to New York to go to NYU because I grew up in Los Angeles and I liked it, but I just wanted something a little bit different. And in the process of just making a lot of different short films, I kind of realized that, you know, I wanted to make movies that were true to kind of what got me into filmmaking in the first place, but also kind of what kept me in filmmaking. And so I made a bunch of shorts and one of them, my thesis film, did relatively well. And that got me, you know, representation, an agent and a manager. And then I spent 8 years writing a new feature and writing a new TV pilot every year and kind of just going through this development cycle over and over again. And you know, it's never ever happened to anyone in the history of Hollywood. I'm the only one who's ever experienced that. I had another movie that was set to, we had a lot of the pieces of it together and we were very excited about it. And, you know, we set a date for June 2020 and then obviously that was interrupted. Once COVID hit, everything kind of just fell apart and it felt like, you know, all of these years of starts and stops were, it was like, again, you know, just yet another setback. And I kind of just reached a breaking point where I was like, I'm going to just go and make a small movie and do it at whatever scale I need to do it at in order to get it made, because I'm sick of kind of waiting in this endless kind of repetition of asking people for money and begging people to take the project seriously. And so we started making the movie in our living room.
We'd love to get just like a quick synopsis of the film to get people, to get people's appetites ready for it.
So it's called Molly and Max in the Future. And the easiest way we kind of describe it is that it's When Harry Met Sally in space. And during that time, right after the pandemic hit, when my other film fell apart, we just kind of watched movies because there was nothing else to do. And we rewatched When Harry Met Sally, and it's such a perfect film. And I love it so much, but it was interesting to watch it in the middle of COVID because the movie is just 100% focused on them. And you have no idea what's going on in the world outside of them. Like, it takes place in New York City, but you don't know who's president. You don't know what the health situation is there. And like in a time when that was just at the top of everyone's mind at every moment of the day, it was interesting to see a movie that just had none of that in it. And again, it's a perfect movie. I don't think that they should have changed it to be different, but it felt like you couldn't necessarily like make that movie in today's world where so much of our relationships and our identity are about things more so than just interpersonal relationships. And we think a lot about kind of, you know, what are our privileges in society? You know, what are the systems at play that help or hurt us in a larger social context? And, you know, how does events outside of our control kind of affect our lives? So the idea was kind of just to take When Harry Met Sally and take a story of two people meeting each other over the course of 12 years and then kind of set it in a science fictional universe where you can kind of take some of these feelings that I think a lot of people feel, where you kind of feel overwhelmed by the state of the universe. And how do you kind of use metaphors and allegories to explore those and tell a grounded story of two people, but in a way that people haven't seen before?
As a When Harry Met Sally stan myself, it was immediately apparent watching it that it is heavily inspired by, especially the format of the film, of these like vignettes where they like come together and then they go apart and they recount what has happened in the meantime to each other. But something that I found so interesting was the present feeling to it, to like society today. Mm-hmm. When Zoe and I were watching it, when they started talking about like the election and a pandemic, we were both like, oh, wow, like this is one of the first movies that I have seen that is like directly tackling what we've been through. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like rom-com movies don't often address these things so outright. They tend to be like more secondary if mentioned at all.
And that has been the most divisive part of the film, actually. And it's been really interesting to see because some people really, really respond to that and are really happy about that. And other people, like, they are annoyed that we kind of broke the bubble of escapism. And, you know, mm-hmm. I really don't think that the politics or, you know, there's a small element of COVID in the movie that pops up towards the end. And I don't really see it as like being a huge part of it. It's more so just about kind of like addressing the fact that there are things in life that influence you that are kind of outside of your interpersonal relationships. But, you know, some people really want to just go to the movies to escape for 2 hours, but other people have felt like really seen and they felt like it really speaks to them and feels mm-hmm. relevant and new. And it's been really cool to see the response.
Could you speak a little bit about finding your Molly and Max and how you found your way to Zasha and Aristotle?
So I'd been familiar with Zasha's work since HBO's Girls and The Flight Attendant. And she was just always my favorite part of that show. And I've always thought she's so funny and interesting and unique. And, you know, she brings her own personality to things, but she also has a very wide range. And I wanted to work with people that have improv experience. And part of it, you know, was when I was researching the script, I went and researched about how they made When Harry Met Sally. And You know, Rob Reiner really involved his two leads like in the process of kind of rewriting the film together. And I think that is always a really smart bet, is to just, you know, we were able to have 5 days of rehearsal where we could read through every line of the script, talk about it in a very kind of low stakes environment, and figure out like, how do we make this better together when there isn't the pressure of time and money, you know, breathing down your neck. And so I found Aristotle because he was on SNL and he has a sketch comedy background and he has a stand-up background. And so again, just, I wanted to find people that had opinions on things that were kind of characters on their own and would kind of bring their talents to the movie and not just like show up and say the lines. So, you know, working with them was such a blast. And also what's really important to me is working with nice people too, because you, on an independent film, like our crew was 12 people and it was very, very humble. It was in a very small stage and you need to have people that are kind of down for that adventure. And, you know, like Zasha and Ari both like would offer to help like carry apple boxes from like one side of the stage to the other. And we'd be like, no, what are you doing? Stop that. Like, you know, that, and that's really the kind of people that they are though, is we're like, you need those team players and people that understand like everyone is wearing multiple hats and this is not going to be a luxurious experience, and it'll hopefully still be very rewarding, but you have to have people that have the right attitude about it, because otherwise it'll be even harder than it is.
Speaking about working with nice people, can I reveal that you two are married to each other?
Yes,
surprise. Michael and Joanna are married. Could you both speak about what it was like collaborating with your spouse on a small indie like this?
Yeah, honestly, it was so, so, so fun. And so many people are like, oh, how much did you fight putting the movie together? Literally not at all. I mean, we just don't fight that much normally either. But, I think because it was something about love, something about connecting with people, something that was just trying to be funny and goofy too along the way, we just like had a great time of, you know, I think pulling from different references of films we love, whether it was When Harry Met Sally or like, you know, other films that have just all brought us together over the years. I always say I feel like I had the cheat codes to edit this film because I had read every draft of the script. We've been together for over a decade. I know your sense of humor really well. So it was really fun to just go into cutting the film feeling so confident and feeling like I knew the tone and I knew what you were going for so concretely. And also feeling like we could do so much like experimenting and messing around with stuff without the fear of being like, all right, maybe I'll get fired. I was pretty sure you were going to fire me for pitching a crazy idea. But it just made the whole thing feel so organic. And I think we were really willing to like make bigger changes because we had so much trust. Like, I think that's so integral to the editing room. And it's great when you're working with your partner to just be like, oh, we've built this up in many other aspects of our life. So it just translates to filmmaking so easily too. Do you agree? Are you going to disagree with me?
Michael's like, actually.
I had a terrible experience. It was awful. No, it was great. It really was great. I mean, we edited the movie in 5 weeks, which is kind of insane.
Wow.
For a feature schedule. And part of it was also, was what was really nice was that like we could, you know, take a break and then cook dinner and then go back to work. And we cut the whole movie like in our bedroom. So it was, yeah, really fun. And like Joanna said, I mean, like part of the reason we're married is because we have very similar senses of humor. And I think that, you know, part of the joy of a romantic comedy is like when you have those people that have that chemistry. And I think that Joanna and I do have that chemistry together. So it was really, really fun. One thing that I feel like you say about it is that like, you know, I have a post-production background and I started off as an editor, but I just know for a fact that Joanna is 10 times better at editing than I am. So there's never this like doubt. And I think that like, similarly, like she doesn't really want to be a writer or director. And so there is kind of a clear, you know, delineation of responsibilities and roles in there. And I think, you know, when I've heard stories of couples of working together and it not going well, it's usually when two people have the exact same role and they have a little bit of a power struggle over something. But, you know, and I think we also both just like respect each other's opinions a lot. So, you know, there's kind of a safe space to pitch something and you don't have to worry if the other person doesn't like it.
I'm so glad.
It's good to know that such a sweet film was also so fun to edit and to finish up together.
Yeah, you didn't know if you're going to be like walking into a therapy session where you had to like, you know, really help us work through the emotion, the trauma of working together. But no,
let me pull out everything I've learned in my own therapy so I can help you through right now.
Let me grab my notebook.
Well, I would love to know a little bit about what a day during production looked like on such a small crew and such a, you know, you mentioned it was on a small stage as well.
The first day we showed up, it was 2022 and it was the summer of 2022. And we all took our first COVID test and our first AD tested positive on the very first day.
Oh, no.
And so the whole first week, we didn't have a first AD, which was really, really difficult. And it was honestly different every day because the first week we shot on an LED stage, which was a really amazing experience. And then the last 3 weeks we shot on a small soundstage in Manhattan and we did a combination of like rear screen projection and green screen. And, you know, honestly, one of the hardest parts of the movie is that when you're shooting on a small stage and when you're shooting green screen, you basically place the camera in one spot and then you move everything else around where the camera is. And it really was mentally difficult to be like, okay, the space itself is not changing at all, but we have to rotate the couches and rotate the props and rotate the people and rotate the lights all to be simulate that we're shooting from the exact opposite side of the room. Mm-hmm. But you know, we had a 10 or 12 person crew on most days and everybody had a lot of different jobs, but I think we 80% of our days were only 10-hour days. And that was something where, you know, when we kind of at the beginning of the process, we were like, I feel like freelancers are so just used to being exploited and taken advantage of that committed to doing 10-hour days. And, you know, obviously kind of like sometimes you just need a little bit extra, but we really tried to not push that. And we would always try to make sure that it was only one day of the week that we were doing that. So, you know, it was just a lot of shifting things around inside of a studio. And, you know, the first week our studio didn't have air conditioning and it was a LED stage where it had air conditioning, but it couldn't go on while we were shooting. And it was also,
yeah,
normally the air conditioning was powerful enough to be okay. But it was during the heat wave. And so it was twice as hot as normal. And then on top of that, we had our actors in a Honda Civic, which we redressed to be a spaceship. And then they were wearing spacesuits, which were really just ski suits. And again, it kind of goes back to just like, you need to work with really nice, patient people, because both Ari and Zasha like didn't complain once. And like, I was outside the car in like short shorts and a t-shirt. And I was like dripping with sweat and they were inside a car in spacesuits, in a stage. And like, they were just such troopers.
Oh, I need somebody to pat me down. Yeah. Well, you kind of answered one of my questions. I was wondering about how you created the backgrounds for all of the different worlds. When we first watched it, we set up a projector so we could watch it on a bigger screen. And I kept going up to the screen and being like, that looks almost painted. Like, I wonder how they did this world or this world. It was just so cool and so fun to watch. So I'd love to hear
about
it.
Yeah, totally. So we spent about 18 months and it was usually 1 or 2 days a week, sometimes, you know, 3 or 4, but we spent 18 months kind of building all of the backgrounds for the film. And, you know, we started in our living room and just put up a green screen. And you know, there's part of when I'm writing, when I know that there's no to little money involved, is that I spend a lot of time kind of doing research. And so I don't write something into the movie unless I know how I'm going to pull it off. And so I would write a draft and, you know, there's a good example is like, there's a scene, there's a location in the movie called the Quantum Zone, and it's supposed to like kind of represent depression. And so much of the locations in the movie are supposed to kind of represent internal states of the characters, not always, but a lot of the time. And that's part of the motivation of having this take place in a sci-fi or fantasy universe, is that you can use these things kind of expressionistically. So we had a character that I knew that they needed to be someplace that kind of represented depression. And I kind of just started brainstorming of like, is it a black void? That's not really that interesting. Is it a white void? Also really not that interesting. Is there, you know, are there blobs floating around? Like, could we shoot a lava lamp and then take from that? And like, maybe that could work, because blobs kind of, you know, emotionally the character's kind of all over the place. But in the process of just kind of trying to figure out what's the best way to represent this feeling, I stumbled upon like miniature dollhouse furniture, which is you know, anybody can buy on Amazon for about $20. And so you can get these little dollhouse staircases if you are building a dollhouse. And so I saw that and I was like, oh, what if we built an environment that's kind of like an MC Escher-esque void where you have staircases going to nowhere. And then you can have depth in there. You can have different shapes. You know, it's kind of inherently interesting. And it also gets across this emotional point, which is that this character is feeling lost and disoriented. And so a lot of times it was, you know, I know that this is the thing that we need to accomplish. Let's do a bunch of research, figure out what's the way that we can pull this off for $100. And then let's go shoot it one day. Let's go process it another. And a lot of this really wouldn't be possible without my DP, Zach Stoltzfus, who he has an extensive VFX background. And, you know, the first project we ever worked on together was my NYU thesis, where he helped out on set, but then he also helped with some of the visual effects. And he's kind of gravitated more towards being a DP than a VFX artist, but he has that background. And so a lot of times it was a collaboration of, like, I would say to Zach, like, oh, I have this idea for these staircases or something. And I'd bring them to him and be like, I think this could work. And then he'd be like, that's cool. What if we also did this, this, and this, and, you know, help separate that out. And so he was huge in that, and he has a lot of technical ability, and he built a lot of these systems that we use that help us kind of achieve this all with a two-person team. Because me and him basically did 90% of the VFX from start to finish.
Wow.
on the movie. And we hired some freelancers for very specific things, but there were over 900 shots in the film. I think every single shot in the movie is technically a VFX shot. Also because the stuff that we shot on the LED stage, we built those plates and put it up behind them. So you could place the actors in front of it. And so it was a lot. But, you know, the benefit of it is that we got to have our hands on every single image in the movie. And it was really, really nice to have that kind of control. And I love collaborating and working with other people too, but there's often a kind of, you have to translate what's in your head, versus if you're inside the After Effects project yourself, you can try 5 different variations and then see if something works. And I think 2 people was not enough, and we need to expand it on the next one. But I do think, like, you know, we looked at Everything Everywhere All at Once and kind of how they, you know, kept everything very small and, you know, just tried to, you know, lean into our constraints and figure out what was actually possible with our resources.
Well, I feel like you guys accomplished so much. One of my favorite quotes about indie filmmaking is from Mark Duplass, and he said that feelings and faces are free. And, like, when you really focus, like, on the character and something, you can make a small budget movie that can be impactful. And you guys did that. You focused on the characters, but you had this extra flair of placing it in a sci-fi world. And I feel like it's rare to have a indie film that does choose to, like, cross genre in that way, because you set yourself up a challenge. Like, you guys worked really hard to create those backgrounds, and it makes the film feel scrappier because you guys, like, added that extra goal for yourselves.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's a really good quote. I really like Mark Duplass, and I think a lot of his filmmaking advice is really, really sound. And yeah, I mean, the thing that I always say kind of to myself is just, like, there's nothing cheaper than a great character. And I think that was kind of the philosophy from day one, which is just focus on making them interesting people to watch, and then all this other stuff is kind of bonus.
We have some, like, nitty gritty questions about the movie. Yeah. Zoe, I think you had one about soda you wanted to ask.
Oh, I really was just wondering, what does Diet Glorp soda taste like?
It's, oh man, it's whatever you want it to taste like.
Okay, perfect.
There's a lot of different flavors. So, you know, they have scraped all your data and found out exactly what your taste and flavor profile is, and they've customized it to make the perfect flavor for you.
Fantastic.
Excellent.
In terms of the costumes and lighting, we noticed that Molly is always in reds and Max is always in blues. Did you have any, like, deeper symbolization there?
Yeah. So one of the things I like to do, and I didn't really do this before Molly and Max, was, like, I start a document on PowerPoint or Google Slides, like, that I call a style guide. And in animation, style guides are something that they give to the different animators, because you have, like, 15 different people drawing the same you know, Lilo and Stitch characters or something. And so you need to communicate to them like, okay, no, the back of this character is usually thicker than the front, or like the lines on this side of them look this way, and this is how they look from the side, and this is how they look from the front or the back, or, you know, any number of angles. And so I started along with Zach, you know, kind of building out a style guide for the movie. And we also had that kind of augmented a lot by our production designer, Violet Overn, and she came on and helped us take that to the next level. But in that kind of early style guide, it was like, how do we separate these people visually? And when you look at When Harry Met Sally, like, it is a really visual movie. It's also just two people talking the entire time, but they do a really good job of kind of every scene is shot in a different way, and they don't really repeat themselves. And part of it was in that style guide was like, let's go through romantic comedies and see the way that they're shot. And often so many of these great movies are very, very simply shot. It's a two shot and two over the shoulders or two singles. And, you know, with the exception of like the Before trilogy, where you have a lot of walk and talks and, you know, but it was like, okay, let's go break down all those movies and see the way that romantic comedies are shot traditionally. You know, is that something that we want to emulate or not? And then on top of that, there was like, how do we separate them visually? And so from the beginning, it was like Molly's color palette was always warm colors, and Max's was always cold colors. And then on top of that, there was like, you know, I am also a cartoonist. I like to draw a lot. And when you learn about drawing and cartooning, they talk about like line quality and what does your line quality kind of say about your art. And so I kind of decided from the beginning that like all of Max's, in Max's set and in Max's worlds, it was going to be kind of, you know, octagonal shapes and kind of no 90 degree angles, which is kind of a classic sci-fi thing. That's why like hexagons and octagons are so popular within sci-fi. It just kind of communicates that. And then on Molly's, there's another kind of side of sci-fi, which is like if you watch the Alien movies or, you know, the opening of A New Hope, where everything is like white and sleek and very curvy. And, you know, that's like one kind of subgenre of sci-fi design as well. And so from the beginning, you know, I had in the style guide, like Max's worlds should be inspired by this type of sci-fi and Molly's world should be inspired by this type of sci-fi. And that was kind of a jumping off point. And then Violet really helped me kind of take that to the next level. But some of those kind of concepts were baked in there.
Totally. And the only other thing I'd add is like also on kind of a basic level, like Molly's supposed to be someone who's like more in tune with their emotions and a little bit more open. So like the warm colors, I think like represent that a bit more, whereas Max is a little more calculating, a little bit more repressed and very scientific. And so I kind of feel like the cold colors also just like on an immediate level, that's kind of what you associate with something that's more like rosy versus like cool. So I think that it works on so many levels.
Definitely. Joanna, when we spoke about The Bear, I know we spoke a lot about music. So I was wondering, how did you approach the edit? And did music come in at the start or later on? Because the jazz was excellent. I loved the jazz music. I thought it worked so well. I feel like I got lost in it sometimes where I didn't even notice it anymore. And it was just listening to them talking. So curious on how you approached that.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, that was something Michael had envisioned from the beginning and I think worked because jazz has such a like timeless classic, you know, feel to it. And I think we talked a lot about you not wanting to have like pop culture references that would like date the film because it's in this unspecified time and it's just in the future. So I think having something like jazz that everybody, you know, makes them think of the past, but you never know how far in the past it is, works well with this thing that's a little bit unstuck in time and should still be relatable, even if it's in this outlandish universe. And so you hired Alex Winkler, an amazing, amazing composer. And he was actually working on, I guess, Molly and Max's theme pretty early on. So we were able to play around with his track during like the editing process, which was great. And it kind of became their theme. So a lot of times when they're talking together, we would kind of bring that back in. And then on top of that, the two most fun sequences to cut, I think, are chapter 3 and chapter 4, which are the really kind of like fast-paced flashback montages. And we had like temp music in those two sections. And we were just like, I don't know how we're going to be able to beat it. It's like a Benny Goodman song. It was like a Dave Brubeck song. We were like, these are so good. And then Alex wrote something even better that still captured like the energy to it. So I love kind of, especially when you're doing something montage-y, having a temp track, having something to just like find that pace, keep things moving. Those sections also, it's just like, you're introducing new characters. There's all these jokes. Like, you need to watch it a couple times to even see all the references. So I think just having as that driving thing that was just pushing us to cut faster and faster and just embrace kind of the absurdity of this world was really helpful to have from the beginning. And then once we put in Alex's final track, we like didn't even have to change much at all. We were just like, yep, he nailed it. This is great.
If I'm correct in my memory, you do have a needle drop of It Had to Be You, the like classic song from When Harry Met Sally. Or was that an alt version that sounded like it?
That was just inspired by, right? I mean, it's all original music, right?
100% original score.
I was so sure. I feel like the first song that opens the movie, I was like, oh, it's When Harry Met Sally. I'm ready. Joanna told us it was like When Harry Met Sally meets Rick and Morty. And I was like, there we go. We're starting with It Had to Be You.
Amazing. Well, I think that's the feeling we wanted to conjure for sure. So again, kudos to Alex Winkler for doing such a great job of tricking you into thinking that it was the actual score. But yeah, I think that was the direction you gave him, right? Like that's what you wanted more than anything.
Yeah, I honestly don't remember what temp song we had in there. It definitely wasn't that as temp because I don't think it was like a specific iconic song. It was kind of like placeholder jazz. And he like reached out and was like, can I see cuts so that I can start composing? And I was like, yes, but they aren't picture locked. So, you know, don't get too married to the timing, but like, here's the first draft of kind of what it's looking like. He was then able to kind of send us stuff back. And then we were able to change things slightly to fix it. But yeah, he's just incredibly talented. And it was really, really fun working with him. And yeah.
He worked so fast too. That was also what was so impressive. We were like, oh, you know, can you just write something for here? I think originally you probably weren't even expecting to have as much music as we did. And he kept doing such a good job. We were like, can we give you one more scene? And like, he's like, yeah, of course. And like the next day he'd be like, here's something I threw together. And he was really smart about like, yeah, using recurring themes and having things that kind of built on each other in just a really natural way that I think also worked with the story.
Yeah, that the last scene in the movie when, spoiler, they, you know, good things happen. It's a romantic comedy. It's not that loose, right? In that last movie, like the temp score was, I think, Clair de Lune by Debussy. And I was like, oh, this is a classical song. We could probably get the rights to this for an affordable number. And I was kind of like, Alex, I don't want to, he was already doing so much that I was just like, if you want to not have that scene, if you want that scene to be something outside, like we can take that off your plate. And he was like, let me just take a stab at it. And like he sent in the version and there were no notes. It was like, he just nailed it on the first try.
Wow.
Which was kind of insane. So yeah, I was really thrilled that we got an all original score because there's so much music in the movie. There's 30 to 40 minutes worth of music in there.
Yeah, it worked so well. It's one of my favorite parts of the movie is the music within it.
Definitely. And he recorded the actual score with all like real musicians. Like that wasn't just, you know, garage band, you know, AI instruments. Mm-hmm. And I think you can really tell. Like it really feels like, you know, it has that life to it and it really is very captivating. So we love him. A+ for Alex.
You guys really accomplished so much with a small budget. And I know that in indie films, securing a budget can be such an uphill battle. We'd love to know if you don't mind sharing how you financed it.
We had 11 different private equity investors, and me and Joanna were two of them. I think 5 out of the 11 investors were people that had like lead roles on the movie in terms of producers, you know, Zach, the DP. One of the things we did was that, you know, I think on a lot of indie films, you ask people to work for a lot less than what they're worth. And I just never want anyone to feel like they're being exploited or being taken advantage of. And so we paid Zach a combination of like upfront money that can pay the rent immediately. And then, you know, normally people are given points on the back end and we gave him those as well. But we did something kind of different where we also gave people investor equity on the movie if they were putting in their time. And so normally the way film deals work is that investors get paid back first. And then afterwards, if the movie goes into profit, the people that have points on the back end get compensated for that. And so you know, I didn't want Zach, who put in so much time and energy into the movie, that he would should be one of the people that gets paid back first, because he spent those 18 months building with me. And so it was kind of a non-traditional setup, but that is the beauty of making your own movie, is that you can kind of design whatever system you want to make it fairer for everybody. So it was a, you know, really was scrapping it all together and just emailing everyone we've ever met and saying, would you be interested in investing in this film? And, you know, people sometimes say yes, and you're surprised. And some, you know, I think 4 out of those 7 additional like investors that were on the movie, like, we weren't even pitching them on it. Like, they, for some, you know, one of them was a friend of our producer, and he was on set on a commercial that he was shooting. And she was just like, oh, what are you up to? And he's like, I'm producing this movie. And she's like, do you need investors? And he's like, I do. And so like, you know, once you start getting the wheels moving on something, it's so much easier to get momentum, because it's really hard to find those first people to invest in you and believe in you and risk their hard-earned money on you. And if you can be like, this is happening, this is a real thing, you're the last piece of the puzzle, you know, then they're much more likely to kind of be a part of it.
Should we give a shout out to Mac too?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
one of the investors is our cousin's husband, who we love. His name's Mac. And he runs a company called Cleveland Kitchen, which is like artisanal. It started off as artisanal, like sauerkraut. And now they do salad dressings and marinades and snacks and all this stuff. He was one of the like people who just was like, oh yeah, like I'll give you some money to help complete this. And we're like, you're our family, you don't have to do this. And he was like, no, totally. And he was just been such a big supporter and so enthusiastic about the film. So
this episode brought to you by Cleveland Kraut.
Yes, yes. We love a sponsorship bit.
I don't have a sponsor bit by Cleveland Kitchen.
Everyone knows that rom-coms hinge on if there is chemistry between the leads, because it's going to be a snooze fest if it isn't. So, Jana, can you speak to how you found that chemistry in the edit between Zasha and Aristotle?
Yeah, I'd say that was one of the main things we were focusing on while we were cutting, because I think Zasha and Ari are both already such likable people, but we really wanted to like feel that, and you want to be rooting for them. I think one of my biggest pet peeves in rom-coms is like, these people look at each other and now they're in love, and you're like, I'm not feeling any of this. I don't feel invested. And I feel like there's very few rom-coms that do that well. I mean, When Harry Met Sally is one of them for sure. So that has always been like our North Star. But I think one of the things we really found were like moments of just like eye contact between them, having like these kind of like pregnant moments of like, you know, silence and a little bit of like longing and not really maybe wanting to admit that they were feeling these feelings. Because I think that's also, you know, the conflict is like, they are both feeling these feelings, but they don't want to accept them. And then they have the whole scene with the poo box where you're like, see what could be, but then you're scared to, you know, try to defy what the poo box is telling them will happen. So
explain what a poo box
is. Oh yes. Maybe I should explain what a poo box is. That is something called a parallel universe box. Not at litter box or anything like that. But yeah, there's a scene in the movie where they kind of like go on this like alternate path, and they see what their relationship would be like if they decided to take their friendship to the next level and become romantic with one another. And it goes terribly. And so for a while, it really prevents them from confronting these feelings or acting on them. And they realize they have to grow a little bit more as people before they're willing to give it another shot. So yeah, I think just finding, we used a couple of improvs too, where they actually are making each other laugh. And those are some of my favorite moments in the movie. Ooh. There's like a joke where, you know, Zasha's in the air cab or in her spaceship and is like, oh yeah, I didn't fart, it's the ship. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ari's like, yeah, if your butt is called the ship. And like, that's them actually just cracking each other up. So I think that was a great moment that, you know, the script was so strong, but also finding those things that felt maybe a little bit more loose or a little bit more like authentic and leaning into those as well. And then, yeah, just building out those moments where it felt like there were feelings under the surface that weren't being said. I think because it's such a talking heavy film and there's so much great dialogue, but we really had to work in those silences too, to really feel like, when do we want to take a breath and just see them look at each other, processing these feelings. And I think that built a lot of depth between their connection too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really interesting, because we did like test screenings where we would bring 3 or 4 people over, and some of them knew about the movie and some of them didn't. And we would sit them down on the couch and watch the movie with them and see where they laughed, where they didn't laugh, and then ask them questions afterwards and see, you know, was this working? Was this not working? We also sent out individual like Framio links to people and got, you know, feedback from people that were in Los Angeles or somewhere else that, who couldn't come to our apartment. And, you know, the first couple cuts, everybody was kind of universal and being like, they don't have enough chemistry together. And,
oh, wow.
And then by the, you know, by the last little test screening, we would do it. We would do a new cut and do a new screening like every 3 or 4 days. And by the end, nobody was bringing that up and everybody was calling out how great their chemistry was. So it really was Joanna, like, did so much to help kind of build that between them. And like she said, like, it's kind of crazy how simple, like, just having two people look at each other and smile, like, does build up a lot. And you can't have it all be that, but it really does go a long way.
Yeah, 90 minutes of people just looking at each other. But no, yeah, it's true. It's like, you really can, you know, there was never a doubt that they weren't good performances. It was just like, what are the moments you really want to highlight and, like, you know, reconfigure a little bit to, like, yeah, just really show that there's, these two people are really changing for the better because of each other. And that is what's making them fall in love and bring them closer together. You know, that's all stuff that you can say with dialogue, but also if you have a really good actor or actress, you'll see on their face. And that was always there, you know, in the footage. It was just a way to, like, bring it to the surface and make sure that's what people were connecting with first and foremost.
I feel like in editing, everything is like, it's so, such a tiny difference will be revolutionary. Like lingering for an extra second on a shot can completely change the tone. So I think it's so cool that you guys had the ability to do these, like, new cuts and then get feedback and then see how it was going. Because I mean, everyone, you know, edits in their own way and people obviously show it during the process. But that sounds like a unique, like, a ton of extra feedback that you guys were able to get.
Yeah, definitely. I think we're really lucky that we both went to NYU. That's where we first met. And we keep in touch with a lot of our classmates who are all, you know, mostly working filmmakers. And so it was really grateful to have them be some of the first people to watch it because they weren't like, wait, what's this green screen doing here? Like, we were able to send them a bunch of caveats, but we also really tried to send it to people who kind of work completely outside the film industry and also make sure that it was resonating with them. So I think, you know, we'd get to the point where we're like, okay, we think this is feeling pretty good. And then we'd share it with people and be like, oh, this feels so obvious now, but, like, you know, it would re-energize us and give us things to try. And it was always very, I think, exciting to kind of hear what people were really liking too, because we were editing it with such a small team in such a small bubble that, and, you know, just getting the reassurance too that things were working well, we could focus on that and then also try to bring everything else up to that level.
Definitely. I mean, we also gave people deadlines and we were like, if can you watch this in the next 24 hours? And if not, then we're up in like 4 days and then can you watch it in 24 hours? And we were just like, we were like scrambling to hit festival deadlines. And one of the other things that was really important that we needed to test was that because 30% of the movie is shot on green screen and there's some very pivotal scenes that are shot on green screen, you know, we did temp keys inside Premiere and then we would put temp backgrounds behind them. And we wanted to make sure that, first of all, people understood where something was taking place. And so you have this like fuzzy TikTok outline around. it can be very distracting, but like, we were just like, okay, did you get that this scene took place inside an apartment, even though that background was green screen? And, you know, we definitely spent a lot of time just making sure that to someone who had no idea what was going on, that they at least understood the basics of like, where are they? What are they doing? And that the VFX didn't get too much in the way of the viewing experience. And then as we were going, we would be updating the VFX and making them, you know, look a little bit better every time. But I think those initial test screenings were also really important for that, because we eventually had to send it off to festivals and we didn't have someone there to be like, that's a bedroom or that's, you know, a different place. So we had to just make sure that that was airtight.
Yeah, our early temp VFX of Mobius are crazy.
So many
different like layers and stuff, and he looks way better now, but it would always make people laugh, I think, the first time they saw him. Because at least, like, imagine a brain with tentacles. So anyway, it was very fun to see the evolution of it. Yeah.
Well, speaking of festivals, can you speak a little bit about what festivals you attended and what that experience was like?
We premiered at South by Southwest in 2023, which was really a dream come true. You know, I've been trying to get a movie in there for about 13 years. And so I was really, really happy. And it was the perfect place to premiere it. And It got a really great response, and the audiences really loved it. And we got, 20 people from the movie or associated with the movie, basically everybody that was on set, all 12 of them, plus the investors and almost everybody involved in post and everything were able to be there. And so that was really magical. And after that, we played at a lot of really great festivals around the world, which was really exciting. One of my favorites was BFI London, which is, a pretty prestigious place. I was kind of surprised we got in there because this movie is so ridiculous. And that was kind of crazy to go to London and explore and show the movie to an international audience. And we played at Sitges in Spain, which was really cool. Fantasia in Montreal, Oak Cliff in Dallas, which is a really cool small festival. Fantaspoa, which is in Brazil. And so it was really amazing just being able to like travel the world with the movie. And in Brazil, we played, that was our first international audience. And this festival, Fantaspoa, is like it's a small city in Brazil. It's like not a tourist destination really. And they subtitled the movie in Portuguese. And it was crazy because half the audience would laugh because they read the subtitles. And then the other half who did speak English would laugh after the character said it out loud. And you just never know with a comedy if something's going to like travel across borders, because comedy can be sometimes like very culturally specific. But it was really, really cool that it got like great laughs. And even though it was in like a translated, language. And so that was really cool and rewarding and really fun.
Oh my goodness. What a dream to like travel with your like passion project. I would love to know if you have any stories from either the production or post-production process that were just wild and silly and absurd that you would love to share.
Yeah. So the final shot in the movie, or not the exact final shot, but like one of the last shots in the movie is, again, sorry, spoiler, they kiss at the end of the film.
What? Ew, kissing.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. So they kiss at the end of the movie, and that was on our small stage. And we have a clip of this at the end in the credits, where basically we had them sitting on apple boxes strapped to a pallet dolly. And in order to get this final epic 360 shot, we had one of our producers and our first AD kind of sitting on the ground, spinning around this pallet while the background behind them was animated. And it was really fun, but also kind of just insane, because that was our last day of shooting and everybody was exhausted, and we had to time everything perfectly because it was like you press play on the background plate and then you have 5 seconds before the background starts moving. And so then we would have a countdown, and then the actors also have to kiss and perform while this is happening. And so we'd yell like action, roll, play, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then we also had to time the ending with that as well. And so it was like, okay, they're going to be spinning for a total of 10 seconds. And so once the spin starts, then the countdown starts again of 10, 9, 8. And so then they had to like start it at the perfect time and end it at the perfect time while they're like crouched down below frame, spinning these two people on the chair. So that was just kind of absurd and a really good time. And it only took us 15 takes.
Oh, wow.
I would need a little bit of Dramamine for all those spins.
Exactly. Yeah. Going back to just having people that are down for the adventure.
That's awesome. On the flip side of that, was there a moment during this experience that was really meaningful for you?
I mean, I just remember like we were rushing so much to get it done for South By. We basically got into South By. We were like, this is amazing. Now we're going to work nonstop to finish the VFX. And like, we literally like sent them the DCP 3 days before our premiere. So like,
We asked them, we're like, when is the absolute last second that we can send you our DCP? Because we need every single second. And
not because we were procrastinating, just because it was just so, there was so much VFX, so much we were doing to get color and sound. And I just remember like sitting in the theater, and it was a packed theater for the premiere. And the lights went down and like the jazz music started, and I just started crying. I was like, it's happening, because like literally like we made this in our house. It was like such a labor of love. So many people we trust and who did us favors to make it happen. And like, I was just like, and now it's a movie, and now there's like strangers in the audience about to watch this. And we were a little stressed watching the whole thing to be like, no tech issues. And then it was beautiful. It played back flawlessly. And then it was just like, all right, it's kind of like we birthed this movie, and then it's going out into the world and taking on a life of its own. So that was like such a special moment for me. That's when it became like real, you know, this isn't just something that like we did as a fun hobby for several months, you know, would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first screening, I was just stressed the entire time because I was like, we were the ones doing the QC on the DCP. And at that point, our brains were fried and like both me and Zach would watch it and just like, but you know, you never know if like a black square is just going to pop up in the exact second that you blink and then your nightmare at it. Then at the festival screening, you have a bunch of tech like glitches on your movie that just make it look slightly less professional. But so the whole first screening, I was just kind of like gripping the edge of my chair and being like, please don't have any fucking technical errors.
We didn't, and
we got through it. And so it was just like a big sigh of relief. And then also between the first and the second screening, we got like all of our first round of reviews, which were all very positive. And we're still at like 94% on Rotten Tomatoes. So like having the relief of the critical response, like not hanging over. And so then at the second screening, I sat in it again and it was a much smaller theater and it was really cool because there was a guy that was in the row in front of me, like kind of in the middle. And I was like in the back right corner and I could just see that he was like leaning forward and he was smiling like the entire time. And I was just like, that's fucking awesome. And he's just a complete stranger. And that was just really, really fun and cool to like show it to somebody who'd never seen it and have them just, you could tell that they were really enjoying it.
Oh man. I mean, that's why we make things, is to share them. And so I'm so glad that experience has been beautiful and exciting for you. And I think that you guys might have a theatrical release on February 9th. Is that true?
We do. Yes, we do. We are going to be playing at select theaters across the country on February 9th. So if you go to mollyandmax.com, which is M-O-L-L-I, we will have the list of theaters up there in the week leading up to the release. And we are also on social media where we're going to be posting a lot of behind the scenes stuff. And also, you know, making sure everybody knows where they can go see it in theaters.
That's so exciting. I'm excited to see it on a big screen.
Yes.
The projector at Zoe's was fun, but a big screen will be very cool.
We're getting a little movie crew together. We're going to go see it.
Oh, thank you.
Awesome. I think it's a fun movie to see on the big screen. We tried to put some like fun Easter eggs in there as well. I had a lot of fun. I do a lot of like goofy photoshopping for like family birthday cards and stuff. So I was like, great, that's something I can use my very specific skill set for. So we like all the like books in the background of set dressing are all like jokes on actual famous like book titles, like Eat, Pray, Triangulon, and like Of Mice and Fish People. And I'm trying to think, Zen and the Art of the like Mecha Fighting Maintenance. So I think there's things like that like you may not see on like a first viewing, but like if you look closer, you know, and it's fun on a big screen. Sometimes we have people come up to us and be like, oh, that was such a funny thing we noticed. And we're like, oh, great. That was a little detail that we did like kind of just for us, but I'm so glad other people see it too.
And most importantly, on the third viewing, you can see our dog in the corner of a newspaper clipping. And so we snuck a photo of our dog in there. And that is really, you know, what people should be spending their time trying to find.
And if you've listened to Joanna's bear interview, you'll know that she snuck her dog into a moment in the bear as well.
I'm starting to worry we sound like crazy people. We're like, we just got into filmmaking for our dog's career on screen.
It's a very cute dog, an adorable dog.
We love Maple. Shout out to Maple. Yeah.
She's a star. Maple's a star.
Yeah, we have become crazy stage parents, just trying to further her career above all else, but that's okay.
Well, we know that you guys had a small budget, but were you able to give out a set or wrap gifts when you guys finished production? And if so, what were they?
Yeah, everybody got a shirt, which you can see I'm wearing right now. We gave everybody a shirt with the name of the movie on it. And then we also gave everybody a mug that said, don't talk to me until I've had the floor. So, and I don't know if it's weird to have a wrap gift be able for purchase online, but we do sell that on the online store.
Yes.
But they got it for free for working on it.
And our personal wrap gift to ourselves is we still have a ton of the miniatures too. So we have like the miniature spaceships and we have a bunch of the like city stuff. So less than we had during production. we cut down some of them, but that's just fun to have kind of artifacts of the film too.
Yeah. We call it a personal wrap gift. not just junk lying around the house.
Well, it wouldn't be a Last to Leave podcast if we didn't ask what your favorite movies are. Joanne, I know we've asked you this, so are there any movies you've seen recently that you've really loved? And Michael, of course, what are some of your favorite movies?
Oh, nice. Yeah, I'd say, like, I'm trying to remember what I said on the last podcast, but I'm sure it was like Catch Me If You Can. I absolutely love Fargo, Back to the Future. And then my favorite movies of this year is I loved Past Lives so much.
Oh, yes. Favorite movie of the year.
So good. Also loved Poor Things. Absolutely loved the movie Bottoms, which is so funny and so great. And the second installment of the Spider-Verse movie. Those are like kind of my top of the year. They're all so great.
I think favorite top four of all time are probably Rushmore, The Lobster, Jurassic Park, and Amelie.
Oh, excellent.
Like those kind of represent the spectrum of like the different types of movies that I think are my favorite. Oh yes, of course, Paddington 2, but great movie. Which brings me to current favorite movies. Wonka just totally slaps in the best way possible. I loved Wonka. Seriously, it was great. Past Lives was incredible. I loved Poor Things. I'm a Yorgos stan. And also the Spider-Verse movie. It was great. So yeah, it's been a good year for movies.
It was 2023. It was truly an incredible, like the best year in a long time for movies. Especially because Molly and Max was on the festival circuit. So.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
Well, but before we go, we always love to ask our guests for advice they'd offer aspiring creatives. So Michael and Joanna, if there is some person sitting in their home dreaming of making an independent film, what advice would you offer them?
I mean, I think that it's really easy to get distracted by wanting to make a big movie. And I think it's really important to start small and to make small things and learn from them. And, you know, I was frustrated at how long it took me to make this film in a lot of ways. It took a very long time. And I learned a lot through making a lot of those shorts. But I think that, you know, it had to happen the way it did. But I think just in general, like making things improves your skills. You learn a lot about yourself as an artist, and it takes the pressure off because the more you make stuff, the less the stakes feel like if it turns out badly, then you know, you've wasted a bunch of time and money and energy. And so I think, you know, I think you get to quality through quantity sometimes, and you can get bogged down in kind of, you know, wanting to be seen as legitimate or wanting to make something bigger so that you're taken seriously. And I think just keeping things small, making movies with your friends, you know, and having a good time while you're doing it is really important.
Yeah, I agree with all those things. And yeah, kind of to build off what you said, so many people who worked on this movie were people who we've known since film school and, you know, have the opportunity to work on way bigger things, but luckily were willing to help us make this, you know, crazy film come to life. And so I think it's just a, you know, a testament to building lifelong creative relationships and collaborations and continuing to help people with their crazy passion projects. And hopefully they'll just keep growing bigger and bigger because, yeah, I think Molly and Max is just a testament to all the love and sweat and effort that our friends and family and crew put into this. And I'm so proud of it. I'm so proud of the work everybody did on it. So it's really a really special little time capsule of this thing we were able to make together.
Well, we've made it to our last question, and you've kind of answered it before, but I'll ask again, where can people follow you both to keep up with your career, and where can people follow Molly and Max?
I'm on Instagram at Michael Litwack, and we also have a Molly and Max Instagram. They post this exact same things. I also just started a TikTok, which is also at Michael Litwack. And so we're posting a ton of like behind the scenes stuff on those accounts. And then at mollyandmax.com as well.
Well, thank you guys so much for chatting with us. So like you guys sending us a screener was like,
we felt so cool.
Yeah, it was our first screener. This is our first time promoting something that hasn't come out yet. And so this was like a first for us. Mm-hmm. And we're so glad that we were able to talk about your beautiful film.
Y'all, it's so good. It's so good. And as soon as we stopped watching it, I turned to Heather and I was like, I don't know how to tell them, or like, I don't know how to make them believe me that I really loved it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it. And thanks for having us and getting the word out about the movie. I really appreciate that too.
Definitely. Yeah. That's the thing is like indie movies kind of like live or die by the like, you know, cult following, like spreading the word of mouth campaign. So this is huge for us too. So we just really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for joining us for this truly incredible interview. We couldn't be more excited to go see Molly and Max in theaters literally tonight. It's out today, people! We'd like to thank Michael and Joanna again for taking the time to chat with us. We'd like to thank Lee Walls for our logo and ML Abbott for our theme music. You can find their socials in the episode description.
You can follow us at Last to Leave Podcast on Instagram. Make sure that you subscribe to Last to Leave on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode.
You can even rate and review the show to help more film nerds find us.
We'll be taking a cute, tiny little hiatus, but don't fret, there'll be more Last to Leave before you know it. Until then,
see you, film nerds!
This has been a Sondercast. Diet Glorp!